From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made December 10th, 1998, in Rochester at the Sister Cities Bridge. A group of people gathered for a candlelight vigil on the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The declaration was adopted by the United Nations General Assembly in Paris in 1948. It represents the first attempt to create a global doctrine of human rights, applying to all human beings. It consists of 30 articles and a number of other provisions. Well, that group in Rochester 16 years ago was attempting to refocus attention on human rights, and in the intervening years, they've held annual programs, choosing a part of the human rights platform to consider in detail. The annual Human Rights Day is coming up Wednesday, and the focus in Rochester is on this question. Is capitalism compatible with human rights? We'll welcome your thoughts on this issue. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can tweet to the program, at Evan Dawson. And our panel for the hour considers this question and more. And let me go ahead and welcome the panel. Mary Boyd is a Human Rights Day Committee member, a longtime activist here, and nice to see you in studio. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you very much for asking us. We appreciate it.
Pat Mannix is also on the committee. And Pat, your bio says you're a retired organizer who is still organizing, so I guess you're not retired.
Well, I'm retired in that I don't get paid anymore.
Oh, I see. But you're still working.
Oh, harder than when I was getting paid.
Very good. Daniel Ponder is here, who is a criminal defense attorney with the Monroe County Public Defender's Office. Daniel, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And also in studio is Colin O'Malley, organizing director of Metro Justice. Colin, thank you for being here.
Absolutely. Thanks for inviting us.
Well, Mary, when you and I first talked about this issue coming up here, you reminded us that when it comes to Human Rights Day in Rochester, you've been choosing individual prongs or parts of the platform of this doctrine of human rights to focus on. Why capitalism this year? Why consider the question of whether capitalism is compatible with human rights?
Well, the big reason is precisely because we have been focusing on a different article every year and choosing different issues that in the area to see how we work, how they measure up, how the U.S. measures up in its treatment of people and its human rights violations, actually, often, to be frank. This year, we decided that maybe we should look at a little more of the root causes. Why are we still worrying and working and against the tide, as it were? We've been working against poverty. We've been working for racial justice. We've been working for women's rights for many years, and not much seems to change. So we looked at the economic system under which we all live. Is it possible that the reason nothing changes is because we're living under an economic system that in itself thrives on these inequalities?
Let me also make a correction here. Human Rights Day is the 10th. It commemorates the what will now be 66 years
right.
since Paris, 1948. But the program, when's the program, Mary?
The program is tonight.
Tonight, okay.
We have a community potluck at 5:30, and at 6:45, the program starts.
Okay, so
at Downtown United Presbyterian Church, which is 121 North Fitzhugh Street. We've been holding it there for quite some time now. And it's right across. There's free parking after 5:30 at City Hall parking lot, and that's right across from the church.
Before I get to some of the defense of capitalism, because in preparation for this program, knowing the disposition of the panelists, I certainly wanted to look into what's been written on the compatibility of capitalism and human rights. And there's a lot of interesting takes on this, and we're going to get the entire panel first here. But Mary, before I go around the room here, if you're saying capitalism is not compatible with human rights, what's the system that could be? What's the alternative?
Personally, I'm just saying I believe it is not compatible with human rights. I think that there's a difference in capitalism and having, obviously a market where people buy and sell. I think we need a more economically just system that tends more towards cooperation. I'm not an economist. I'm just saying cooperation and a better distribution of wealth, a system that does not rely on companies going offshore for its workforce and providing low-wage service jobs here at home.
But that doesn't mean that capitalism couldn't make those changes and still have capitalism, right?
I don't believe that you can, because I believe, and again, I am not the expert at this table, I believe that the purpose of capitalism is to acquire more and more money to move wealth around. And because and to allow people to make as much money as they want, quite frankly. And therefore, the biggest companies, the corporations that run this country, that fairly, that run this country, are not about to agree to distribute the wealth more fairly because their riches depend on low-wage workers.
Let me ask Colin O'Malley from Metro Justice. I know you've studied this issue as well. Do you agree with Mary's position that there is an inherent incompatibility with capitalism and human rights as described in that 1948 declaration by the United Nations General Assembly?
Certainly. And I think, you know, I think when we think about capitalism, there's a variety of versions of capitalism we're really talking about, right? There's sort of the real, like, extreme sort of laissez-faire capitalism that really was the heart of economics in this country in, like, the 1890s, to something more mixed, like social democratic capitalism that happened in the 30s, right? And I think we're really moving and have been moving for about 50 years closer to the old laissez-faire style capitalism, less regulation, fewer taxes on the wealthiest, lower, weaker social safety net, right? And I think if you think about some of the key highlights in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, there are some real key pieces there that capitalism doesn't work well with, right? So the notion of healthcare or housing as commodities to be bought and sold, really makes them not a human right, right? They become a human right when they can be fairly distributed to everybody based on need. If you have healthcare that's bought and sold, then that healthcare that's a rationing system, and it's a rationing system based on income. So, you know, there are some specific moments where having goods and services be commodities on a market bought and sold, I think very much contradict the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, housing and healthcare among them.
We know that the larger a company there is right now in this country or elsewhere, the more political power they're likely to have based on just based on not only campaign contribution, but also sort of the give and take that goes with that. We know that the larger the company you are, the more likely you are to receive tax breaks, credits, all kinds of sort of ways of reducing the taxes paid. Now, I don't want to speak for David K. Johnston, who's an investigative reporter who's been on this program many times, but he often points out to us that the current system that we have in this country is really anti-competitive in many ways, especially to small businesses, to mom and pops, to small stores. It favors big boxes, big companies, big stores. A lot of the breaks go to them because they don't want the competition. And that David K. Johnston has often said that if we had a true system of competition, it would look very different than it is. And I'm only bringing this up to say, Colin, is it possible that capitalism, if you reduce the handouts and what some call corporate welfare, that capitalism could work for human rights and for more egalitarianism?
You know, I mean, this really goes to a baseline definition of what capitalism is. And to be perfectly honest, I disagree with David K. Johnston's definition of capitalism. I think capitalism is not a system meant to make for fair competition. In fact, in a very open, very, you know, non-regulatory world, Walmart still will compete in an unfair way with your local hardware store. Just in terms of having multiple billions of dollars, when the economy dips for a second, Walmart can still lower their prices and wait to drive out of business local businesses.
But Walmart would say, why is that unfair?
Well, just in terms of scale, the likelihood that Walmart will survive a turndown in the economy is considerably better than the likelihood that the local hardware store will survive it. So what that means is, with or without government intervention, capitalism has a tendency to separate wealth, rich getting richer, poor getting poorer. It's a natural tendency that wealth concentrates under capitalism with or without government intervention. Now it's not shocking that when wealth starts to divide like that, that those wealthiest, particularly when we have an electoral system that allows for a great deal of corporate influence, will also start to bend the rules in their favor. But this isn't magical. This didn't just happen on accident. This is the result of hundreds of years of policy, right? In the 1890s, those sort of handouts still happened in a much more sort of laissez-faire moment, right? And they continue to happen, and they will continue to happen when big business are allowed a strong role in government. But even without that, Wealth concentrates under capitalism, and it would continue to do so.
Okay, and so what is the alternative form of government? What beats capitalism for human rights?
Well, you know, I mean, that's a huge question.
It's a fair question, isn't it?
Well, I think it'll take considerably more than an hour to reconstruct society for you, but I do think that there are I think there are some baseline things that could absolutely be happening in society right now that could move us in the right direction. For instance, just over at City Hall right now, there's a hearing about single payer.
We're discussing
healthcare.
The second hour tomorrow. Yeah, will be on single payer. By the way, we're also going to talk to the folks from Vermont Public Radio, which is out ahead of a lot of other states, and we're going to find out sort of the progress they're making, any issues they've had. So tomorrow, second hour is on single payer.
Fantastic.
But you're saying that could be step one.
So I think one step is decommodifying basic services like healthcare. We've actually already done this, right? Nobody pays for nobody's like signing a contract with the fire department to insure them, right? If your house starts on fire, the fire department comes to you. We've already decommodified some institutions in society, and I think it's reasonable to continue that in some areas where those things are necessary for the public good. I think another important step, one of the other things Metro Justice is working on right now, is working with fast food workers across the country who are fighting for a fairer wage and the right to form a union without retaliation. I think giving workers a more organized, clear voice within their workplaces is a real starting point to creating a more just economic system between employer and employee, which capitalism creates.
Yeah, we're talking, you know, whether it's $15 an hour or thereabouts, we've seen that question on the minimum wage and a real living wage. And Colin, a very interesting question that we've tried to tackle on this program throughout the year, starting in January, comes with what the minimum wage is supposed to be. And interestingly, Brian Kolb, who is the minority leader in the state assembly, and others, most often Republicans, when they make this argument, they tell me that, look, we're misunderstanding what the minimum wage is. It's an entry-level wage. It is not supposed to be able to support a family. And therefore, $15 an hour is missing the point and is unsustainable. Whereas a lot of others, generally more progressive, more often Democrats or others, have said, no, that you have to be able to support at least one person, let alone a couple or a family. What do you think, especially in the context of human rights here? What's the minimum wage supposed to be?
Sure, I think the wage should be whatever is necessary for people to be able to work and then meet their basic needs, right? Right now, I have to totally disagree with Brian Kolb on that one. I think he hasn't met the fast food workers I've met. I've met fast food workers who have been working at Wendy's for 17 years and have 6 children and are making $9 an hour.
And he would say, I think, and I'm always careful to speak for somebody, but I think the argument would be they shouldn't be working at Wendy's for 17 years. They should be either looking to move into maybe management at Wendy's or other things.
Sure. And, you know, I think capitalism as it's constructed in our society right now dictates many of those opportunities for people. If college is something that's a for-profit institution that you have to pay heavy money to get into, the likelihood that you're ever going to be able to go on a wage like $9 an hour is pretty low. If ascending into management is the necessary precondition for having a decent livelihood, then that precondition is determined by your bosses, which is, again, a mechanism of social control, right? So in terms of actual real answers for people in getting out of poverty, I think answers like that are inadequate and don't actually meet the need.
Okay, so single payer, minimum wage. Any other prongs you want to mention before we go around the rest of the room?
You know, I'm not even necessarily arguing for an increase in the minimum wage. I mean, I think that that's valuable. But what fast food workers right now are arguing for, and I think this goes more to the heart of the question of capitalism, is for a fairer cut of the slice of the pie that they produce wealth for. Right. So fast food companies, Wendy's, Burger King, McDonald's, nobody's claiming these institutions are poor. They make billions of dollars a year in profits. And that profit is made only by the action of their workers doing the work for them. And then at the end of the day, the industry has a 1,200-to-1 difference between what the CEO makes and the average worker. So your average McDonald's worker 2 years ago made $11,000 a year, while the CEO made $26,000 a day. That sort of incredibly steep divide is something that I think is inherent to capitalism without some form of regulation. And I think one of those forms of regulation is workers having an organized collective voice to demand a fair share.
Danielle, you work as a criminal defense attorney, but I know you're also part of this effort here to put an emphasis on human rights, et cetera. Where do you see this question, especially in your line of work?
Well, I would first say that I'm not in a position to condone or condemn any economic system. I am concerned with economic justice, and I don't really care what ism gets us there. You know, that's my desire. I think we do live in a system that values profit over people. And I think we live in a system that makes it harder to narrow the gap between the rich and the poor. So I, as a public defender, represent poor people. And I can tell you right now, a majority of my cases are people who haven't paid traffic tickets. So not paying traffic tickets and driving a car, you could end up doing time in jail, and many people do. But I often spend hours in court with hundreds of people who haven't paid traffic tickets. And they're in that position because they're poor, because they live in poverty. And I do think we have an economic system that makes it difficult for these people to escape poverty.
Okay. And Pat Mannix, let me ask you, when it comes to what we see, when you just heard Danielle talk about a system that sometimes can put profits over people. And I think a lot of people see stories. I'll give you an example. Don Blankenship is the CEO of Massey Energy in West Virginia in the coal industry. I worked, my first job out of college was as an investigative reporter covering the coal industry for the CBS affiliate down there. And I had plenty of dealings with Massey Energy. And I encountered plenty of documents and personal handwritten notes from mineshaft inspectors, for example, that would really make some people's blood boil. And now we're starting to see that in a much larger volume with Massey Energy. The question I have, Pat, and before we get to the phones, by the way, if you're waiting to jump in, we will get to you. The question I have, Pat, is do we fixate that on that in the media, and does that create a public assumption that the average American corporation is like the Don Blankenships and Massey Energy that almost explicitly, even in writing, are saying, make money, let's worry about safety later, or let's worry about human work conditions later or human wages later? Are we making it a caricature? Are we overgeneralizing American corporations? Or do you think that there is a problem across the spectrum of American corporations?
Well, of course, I haven't investigated every corporation.
No, of course.
I can't, you know, really answer that factually. But certainly the larger corporations, I mean, my favorite target is Walmart, okay, where the average worker makes $9 an hour and the CEO makes $18,000 an hour. Now, when you put that ratio up, how could anyone call that any kind of economic justice? The other part of it that really is so troubling is who picks up the difference there? I do. As a taxpayer, I pick up the difference because I have to pay for benefits that Walmart workers must have to even live. And to me, that's not human rights, you know. That's a form of redistributing the wealth at the wrong level, okay?
So, redistributing upward.
Yeah. So I resent that deeply. And while we're talking about citizens, I think that that's the question in this country we have to ask ourselves. Are citizens' rights and human rights the same thing? And if you are a citizen of this country, why do you not have a right to access a life for yourself that's worth living? I think that one of the problems we have is we're not historically adept in this country. We suffer from a huge lack of knowledge about history and then an ignorance in what we have been biasly told. This system of capital, this system of destroying what I see as one of the things that would help, and that is a return, or not really a return, but an adopting of a more communal way of looking at things instead of the rugged individualistic way that our country has functioned. And that was put in definitely in the beginning to grow capitalism, because communal societies like the Native society that we took this land from and the African society that we brought the enslaved people over to grow our capitalistic society, they were a communal society, and that was very dangerous, that mindset, especially to the poorer in this country, the poor immigrants or the indentureds. This was a terrible risk that they would see this more communal way and want to adopt it. So there was a deliberate attempt to wipe this out, to grow capitalism, for the very reason that I feel we're now at the peak of success for capitalism. where the disparity is larger than it's ever been in this country. And how can that possibly feed human rights? One other thing I want to touch on before we take questions is the rest of our panel, because we will be having Reem Kadane speaking on socialism.
Before you do that, Pat, let me just remind our listeners who are just joining us what's going on, because there's a program tonight. We're talking about Human Rights Day, and they're commemorating 66 years since the 1948 signing that happened in Paris, the United Nations General Assembly, signing that Declaration of Human Rights. And as they commemorate 66 years, this event happens tonight. What are the details again, Pat? Go ahead.
There will be a potluck supper at 5:30, and then at 6:45 we start our program.
Where?
At the Downtown United Presbyterian Church on Fitchew Street.
In Rochester.
And we will start our program. We have a short film on capitalism, just so everybody's on the same page, and very short. And then we have a dynamic opening spoken word poet, Shantara Davis, who is, if you've never heard her, she's electric. Then we have a wonderful panel consisting of Colin O'Malley and Daniel Ponder, who are here today, and then Reem Kadane and Paula Bechtart and David K. Johnston. And that panel will be moderated by Denise Young. And so it's going to be a very exciting evening. And we'll be talking about, capitalism. Can it be reformed? What are some other things that we could put in place of it? And Danielle will be testifying to the real evils that she sees day in and day out from that system.
All right. Our panel for the hour is Danielle Ponder, a criminal defense attorney with the Monroe County Public Defender's Office. She's part of that group tonight, as you just heard. So is Colin O'Malley, organizing director of Metro Justice. Pat Mannix, who you just heard speaking, is a retired organizer still organizing, who is part of the committee, and Mary Boyd as well, part of the Human Rights Day Committee. Let me go ahead and start to get to your phone calls and comments that have been coming in as they examine the question of whether capitalism is compatible with human rights. This is Adam in Clifton Springs. Adam, thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. I'd just like to make a comment that we average citizens are the boss of the corporations, and by that I mean that if we could stick together somehow, we could, let's say, boycott a certain corporation for one day next week and just show them who the boss is. Because if no one went to Walmart for one day or no one bought gasoline one day, I think we could make a difference and show them who the boss is.
Okay. Anybody want to jump in? Thanks for the call, Adam. Anybody want to respond to that?
I mean, I would totally agree with Adam. It reminds me of a quote that I've heard before, that it's hard for poor people to organize, or even middle class people to organize, because they believe they're just temporarily embarrassed millionaires. Everybody thinks they're one paycheck away from the American dream. So I think we first have to deal with that mentality and really do some critical thinking about the majority of us aren't going to be millionaires, and we're not going to have that dream. And until we can get the middle class to align themselves more with the poor working class, then I don't think we'll have much chance at organizing. But I am hopeful that that's possible.
I agree with Danielle, I think, and I also want to thank him for those comments as well. I think that's true, that we are the bosses, or we should be the bosses. And one of the articles of the Human Rights Declaration actually talks about the right to organize and form and belong to trade unions. But unions, for a variety of reasons, mostly I think due to the influence of the corporate sector and due to the fact that people really do not get educated in this country about what's really going on with their situation, have been given a bad rap. A lot of people, even working class people, do not want unions. And it's very hard these days to form unions. Unions have really declined in this country, unlike in other countries. So I think that's a major way for people to organize. Boycotts are great, but I think we have to start educating people as to how they can make a difference.
Jake writes to the program, what your first guest described, and I think that's you, Mary.
Oh, that would be me. Oh, no.
as the ideal system is basic socialism. We know that's never worked in the past. The real problem is human nature and culture differences, not the core economic systems themselves. So they're not really arguing against capitalism, but against our existing corporate system, and those things are very, very different. Let me start with Mary. We'll go around and talk about that. Are you advocating socialism over capitalism?
Actually, I'm advocating probably more of a socialistic system. I'm not a socialist, but more of a socialistic system. I think capitalism distributes the wealth upwards. We want a system, if not socialism, but a mix that distributes the wealth more fairly.
And I think to Jake's question on history, where has that ever worked well?
What I'm not sure if Jake is saying that capitalism has worked well, because I don't think it has. So to say that socialism has not worked and capitalism has worked, a lot of European countries and Canada, where I'm from, for instance, has more of a mix of capitalism and socialism. And I think that works. That has worked much better for more people.
Maybe Scandinavia as well. As an example, I mean,
I think most in Western Europe does have more of a mix.
I'm trying to figure out where it is you think the direction we ought to move.
I think in Canadian and it's had Canada's becoming much more capitalist now under this government. But I think Canada and Western Europe does tend to have a better mix. For instance, most countries, whether it's a mix of private and public, have a better national health care system, have a national health care system that works far better for more people than, for instance, our system does here, even with some of the modest improvements in the current law.
On this program on Wednesday, you're going to meet a doctor who's moving to Canada to get away from the American health care system. So we're going to be focusing a lot this week on healthcare alternatives, folks who are for single payer, folks who are concerned about it, and we're going to meet people in the medical world as well. But let me also kind of go around the room and ask our other panelists as well. Pat, you want to weigh in?
Well, Jeff, was it Jeff?
Jake
mentioned something that really always annoys me in the conversation, and that is, you know, the system didn't work. He does point out that the flaw in human beings, human nature. And I think that that's important for us to consider, that we are never going to find a system where we're going to have utopia. It's not attainable because of all of our human condition. But why should that mean we shouldn't reach for something better? And so to say, well, it didn't work, so let's stay with this rotten system we have, to me, is just the heights of, I don't know, laziness, maybe.
Colin?
Yeah, you know, I think any argument that, like, decides that its backing is human nature is an interesting one, because human nature has been a debated subject since humans, right? So whatever human nature is that he's referring to, I don't know what it is. I think human nature is the whole spectrum of everything from Stalin to Mother Teresa.
I think he's probably referring to the tendency towards avarice.
Sure, which maybe a current facet of human nature, potentially because we have a society that celebrates avarice, right? I mean, that could
be. And I don't mean, by the way, among every single person. I'm talking about people who start to accumulate power.
Sure. Yeah. And I just think that, you know, while on one hand I see greed in my day, I also see, you know, Metro Justice recently put out a call for blankets for the homeless folks living under the 490 Expressway. And the person who offered to collect them had his porch filled repeatedly with blankets and sleeping bags and things for people in need, just out of nowhere, not for any important reason. So I think giving is just as much. I think giving and cooperation are just as much human nature as greed and competition. So I think that's a weak argument. And I also think, you know, we like to assume that capitalism has worked because it's worked for some people in the United States. But let me list a couple of places that capitalism hasn't worked particularly well. Capitalist Philippines did not work particularly well for the people of the Philippines. Capitalist Nigeria did not work particularly well for the people of Nigeria. Capitalist Colombia has been in the midst of civil war for 40 years now. Capitalist Detroit can't provide its people water. Capitalist Rochester is the fifth poorest city in this country. You know, so capitalism, while it does work for some people, doesn't work for huge numbers of other people. And so the question isn't whether it works or not, but who does it work for? So while Scandinavia, I'm sure, has far fewer billionaires than the United States does, it also has far fewer people dying from lack of proper health care or unable to feed their families because their wages aren't high enough.
Considering the question of capitalism and human rights as we approach the 66th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration on Human Rights by the United Nations General Assembly in Paris, 1948, they always commemorate that on the 10th, which coincides with it, but the event in Rochester is tonight, as we've been talking about, our panel here talking about that question of capitalism and human rights. Let's take a 60-second break and right back to the phones. If you're waiting, you're next as we continue the discussion right here on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, we welcome Democrats and Republicans from the Monroe County Legislature as we dig into the $1 billion-plus county budget. They're going to vote on it tomorrow night, but before that vote, it's your chance to talk directly to the legislators, the leaders from Democrats and Republicans. Talk to us about taxes, fees, spending, and budget priorities. Join the conversation next hour on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. When Mary Boyd showed up at WXXI Studios this afternoon, she's on the Human Rights Day Committee. She handed me this handy little document. It says, "Dignity begins at home. Celebrate the Universal Declaration of Human Rights." And from the ACLU, it recounts in simple detail. It's like anybody who's got a pocket constitution. This is like having a pocket Declaration of Human Rights. But
should consult it more often.
Well, Mary, I was just talking and telling Mary that I think most of us do not know. So before we get right back into the question of capitalism and human rights, which you've chosen to make the focus of a discussion this year, what's the broad overview of what is encapsulated here, and where would you encourage people to go to read more about it?
Well, I would encourage people, first of all, to come tonight, where they will all get a copy of that. I know ACLU has copies, and I believe I don't have it right off, but there is a website as well that you can go to get a copy. I guess what I'd like to point out is that it's something that you don't learn about in school. Of all the things you learn about in school, that's an important document. And point out that it was an American, Eleanor Roosevelt, who was largely responsible for getting all those male leaders back then to sign this. The U.S. signed it, took many years to ratify it, and still has not signed many of the conventions that were signed following those years.
Sure. And give me an example of the few of the basic tenets.
Of the original document?
Yeah.
Well, the right to form a trade union, the right to, I believe, adequate health and housing, the right to free speech, the right to be a citizen and to leave your country and come back to your country, in other words, to travel freely.
Mm-hmm.
Help me out here, folks.
Religion,
right to practice religion as you see fit,
right to a trial,
not to
right to a trial,
right
the presumption
trial,
of innocence,
presumption of innocence. To
I know Danielle was going to jump in on that one.
Unnecessary,
if we
did, to in terms of detention, that you can't just be detaining people for no reason.
All right, so it looks across the spectrum, and in recent years, the Rochester Group has been looking at sort of individual prongs of it. This year, it's whether capitalism is compatible with human rights, and I want to get back to the phones now. If you want to call the program, you can do it. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, toll free to call the program. This is Don in East Rochester. Go ahead, Don.
Good afternoon. The only antidote to capitalism is socialism, and under socialism is where the workers, whose labor creates all wealth on the planet, owns that wealth. The capitalists do not spend any point of their, do not create any wealth at all. It is the workers that create all wealth on the planet, so therefore they should own all wealth. As for that other person who said that socialism hasn't worked, socialism hasn't been given a chance to work. Shortly after the Bolsheviks took over in Russia in 1917, 16 capitalist nations sent troops to try and smash the Bolshevik revolution. Hadn't even been given a chance to prove itself, and already the capitalists were trying to overthrow it. They succeeded to a great extent in the early 1990s, but it wasn't because socialism was a failure. It's because it had to defend itself against capitalist aggression. It had to defend itself against say the Nazis who were trying to overthrow socialism, the capitalists in the United States, Britain, France, and so on, who have been trying to overthrow it. That is what has happened. But socialism is where the workers who create all wealth on this planet own all that wealth.
Okay, Don, thanks for the call. First of all, you're getting a lot of nods in the studio, but let me follow up to Don's point and kick it over to Colin with a question, because Colin is someone, again, who can speak about history in many places. He's talking about workers creating wealth. And Don said workers create all wealth. Capitalists are not the ones creating the wealth. You have pro-capitalist folks who are going to say, look, innovation, invention creates the opportunity to create new ideas, new products, and to create jobs. And that without somebody creating an iPhone, that you don't have and again, this is a job, this is one that's easily picked apart because of work conditions, I realize, but someone will say, without the invention of the automobile, without the invention of et cetera, that you don't have opportunities for employment, and you don't have opportunities for the workers to create these products. And therefore, it's unfair to say, well, every worker are the ones creating wealth and the capitalists are not. Colin, what do you make of that?
Sure. I don't think anyone's saying that the inventors don't also have a role to play in that, right? I think what we're saying is that inventors don't have the sole right to all wealth made by those things. I mean, if without a production line of workers, there was never a car built, right? So some of that's, I think, just diversionary almost. When really what we're talking about is at the end of the day, a lot of folks, you know, aren't getting anywhere near a fair share of the pie. In Argentina is where I learned a lot about some of these some different methods of doing some of these things, right? There's a massive economic collapse where the wealthiest in the country literally took all of the wealth with them out of country in 2001. Unemployment skyrocketed in a day. And workers there in many places that held up the economy were workers that said, you know what? We didn't really need bosses in the first place. We're going to continue to run and operate these factories, and we're going to divide up the wealth more fairly. And that's one of the things that helped the Argentine economy survive for years. And they've created what I think is an incredibly important alternative for people all over the world to look to at this point, particularly when we see spikes in unemployment due to economic crises that we did nothing to create.
Is the lesson we don't need executives or bosses? Is that what you're saying?
I think that those executives whose role is largely just sucking up profits are they're unnecessary. Yeah.
Yeah. There are plenty who will agree with you, and there will be plenty who say that that's a vulgar description of what CEOs are doing.
Sure.
But you're...
And in the case that the CEO is doing a great deal of work, then, you know, I think there's an argument to be made that a manager should get a pretty good wage as well. Now, is there anybody who's working 1,200 times or is 1,200 times smarter than their average employee? I find that pretty doubtful. So when organizations like Wendy's and big McDonald's refuse to pay above a decrepit poverty wage, that version of capitalism, I think, is vulgar into itself and a huge problem.
There are some comments coming in via Twitter. In a moment, I'll get to a very specific question for Danielle, one of our listeners had. But before I get that, a couple folks have been waiting for a while on the phones. This is Bernard in Fairport. Bernard, thanks for calling.
Hi. I think the problem with capitalism is it's measured in money. And on your deathbed, are you really going to care how much money you made, particularly if you made more money than it takes to live? And when you think about the rich people in history, they're not all remembered for their money. Carnegie Mellon is not remembered for steel. He's remembered for libraries. You know, will Bill Gates be remembered for Microsoft, or will he be remembered for what he's done against in terms of disease and hopefully for education? George Eastman. It's going to be remembered for Kodak, but he's going to be appreciated for the things that he's done for Strong and for the other places that we're going to get real value from. So I think the problem with capitalism is, A, it's very limited. B, in the long run, as I say, on your deathbed, it's not going to be that important. And so we really need to think about the fact that there are 3-year-olds that are hungry in Rochester, not that there's 26-year-olds making $300,000 at work. So, you know, capitalism is interesting, but it has no, you know, its value is measured in money, and money isn't the most valuable thing in life. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call, Bernard. Response from our guests? Anyone want to weigh in, agree or disagree?
Pat? Well, I would have to say that when the gentleman says that money isn't the most important thing, and I think that that's something you can say if you have some. If you don't have any, it certainly does become of an extremely important thing. And but I, you know, and I question about the things that he says about what people will be remembered for. And in talking about spending, I was just reading recently that the six people who make up the Walmart family, that it would take them something like two, if they spent on the average, what the average family spends in a year in this country, it would take them 268 years to spend down their fortune. So, I don't know.
Anyone else want to weigh in? Well, let me ask a question that came in on Twitter from Misty for Danielle specifically. I think she was listening to some of your comments earlier. And she says, when it comes to middle class, which we've heard a little bit of discussion about, what middle class? It's mostly disappeared. Do we agree with that? And Danielle, I mean, is that a fair construction here in Rochester?
I have no clue. I don't know. But I will say that I think people identify themselves as middle class, whether we know what our actual economic status
is. That's a good point.
We see ourselves as middle class. And when we see ourselves as middle class, we think that we're likely to soon be upper class. So the poor people don't matter. The poor people are using our tax dollars. The poor people are irrelevant. But we really have more in common with the poor people than we have with the CEO of Walmart. You're most likely not going to be a millionaire or a billionaire. You're more likely to be going down when it comes to your financial status than going up. And I think that middle class, or the belief that you're in the middle class, kind of creates this illusion that you too can make it. You can make this American dream. And we really need to realize it's not happening. So the poor people and the people who identify as middle class need to organize against individuals who are valuing profit over people.
I think, and we'll get back to you in a second here, Pat, but I think to Danielle's point, when you talk about, you use the word illusion for someone in the middle class feeling like they've got upward mobility, that it's possible.
Yeah.
You know, this is always a very touchy subject, and I never want to reduce it too simply, but I did see a video that for the first time, it was like a minute long, and I thought, oh my gosh, this nails it. It's a bunch of kids sitting in a class, and there's a trash can at the front of the class. And the kids, every kid is given one walled up ball of paper, all kind of crumbled up. And every kid is told, you got to try to make that shot in the basket. Well, most of the kids in the first row make it. Now, some miss. And one or two in the back row makes a long shot prayer, and it goes in, but most don't. And they said, essentially, that's privilege. Mm-hmm. That there are people born in that first row, and it's pretty easy to knock that shot in the basket. Right. And there are people in the back row who will, but they've got less of an opportunity to do it. And so the question is not, is it impossible? It's not impossible, but it's a lot less likely for certain people in certain circumstances. I did think for me that was a great illustration. And then my question is, how do we make it so it's more of a circle sitting around aiming at a basket, and everyone's got the same distance? You know what I mean?
Yeah, and when I think of that, I've seen that video as well. I think about what I see in the criminal justice system, where poor people are more likely to, first of all, as the public defenders, I think we represent about 75% of people charged with crimes in Monroe County. So the majority of people who are being charged with crimes are poor people. Poor people, if you say to the average person, your bail is $10,000, poor people definitely are never going to be able to make that bail. So they're going to be in custody. They're going to be incarcerated while their case is pending. So because they're incarcerated, they're likely to take a worse deal. It may be a case where they're willing to take probation just so that they can get out of custody. A rich person is not going to have that problem because they're going to be able to make that bail. And we can't talk about economic justice without talking about racial justice, because the majority of our clients are also people of color. And people of color in this community, in this country, are in the economic position that they are in because of racism, because of discrimination that occurred that did not allow them to acquire wealth and pass on that wealth to other generations. So within the criminal justice system, you can see the difference between rich defendants and poor defendants, and the opportunities that they have within the court system. And the fact that, I'll go back to the traffic tickets, is that you can be incarcerated for not paying a ticket, which is a debtor prison, I think, which we're not supposed to have in this country. I will tell judges, he's here because he's poor. If he had your salary, he wouldn't be standing in front of you.
How's that go over with judges?
yeah. Not too well, but
but you say it anyway.
I think some are more sympathetic, but I just try to make that point that we are really criminalizing poverty. And that is the majority of our cases are not rapes and murders. They're petty larcenies, aggravated unlicensed operations, people who are really dealing with poverty. So our system needs to be more concerned with fairness in our economic system as opposed to incarcerating people because we're not getting to the root cause of the problem.
Pat?
I just wanted to make one point on this delusion. I was reading that shortly after the Occupy movement came out and they made famous that 1%, 99%. There was a study conducted by the Siena Research, and they came up with a figure that blew my mind. 42% of the people in the survey actually believed they could become part of the 1%. That is delusion at its highest and speaks very much to why we cannot make progress on these systems.
Well, Pat, they can become part of the 1%. They're 42%? Not likely to.
42%?
No, I'm not saying 42% are going to.
Oh, well, these people believe that it was likely they would.
Okay, well, that is not likely. Actually, math tells us it is not going to happen.
Yes, but they believe that.
Well, I think they may tell you that they think they have a chance. And Misty follows up to say, this panel sounds very one-sided. You're absolutely right, Misty. This is a group in the studio who's got concerns with capitalism. And as the host of the program, I wanted to hear your thoughts. And I'm going to get one more phone call in a second. We're coming back to the phones in 1 second. I would just say, recently on the program, we had a group from Conscious Capitalism in. They talk about ways to improve business capitalism, government activity, through a focus on ethics, but in the promotion of capitalism. And I'm always willing to welcome many points of view. Sometimes, next hour, for example, we've got Democrats and Republicans talking Monroe County budget. Sometimes it's one side of an issue at a time, but we will not, in this program, ever deviate from our goal to eventually bring in all voices of the community. So there you go. There's your disclaimer for that. So, but you're right, Misty. This is a group that is focused on their concerns with it. Can we get one more phone call, and then we'll get some closing thoughts? This is Pete. Thanks for calling, Pete.
Good afternoon. First of all, a quote from Lincoln. Labor is prior to and independent of capital. Capital is only the fruit of labor and could never have existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is the superior of capital and deserves much higher consideration. Second, capitalism is basically corporatism. Its foundation is corporatism. The only legal obligation of a corporation is profit. Profit. When your only obligation is profit, you're neglecting human rights and the environment. You can't do that. It is not compatible with human rights. Finally, I would suggest an article in The Atlantic. Americans want to live in a much more equal country. They just don't realize it. We asked thousands of people to describe their ideal distribution of wealth from top to bottom. The vast majority, rich, poor, GOP, and Democrat, imagined a far more equal nation. And they were questioned. I think it was 92% of the people agreed that they wanted a distribution of wealth that was more like Sweden's. They were given a choice, a distribution of wealth that currently exists in this country, one that they thought existed, and the one that they preferred. They preferred the one out of Sweden. And the question they were asked about where socialism worked earlier, well, let's take a look at the Scandinavian countries. That's what comes close to socialist governments. They're democratic socialist governments.
Pete, thanks for the call. Yeah, I appreciate the call. We only have about a minute left, so let's make sure Mary reminds our audience, because this conversation, this is just the seed of it. It will continue tonight, no matter where you are. And I think that they would welcome anybody, whether you are socialist, capitalist, something in between. That's what they want here. Mary, tonight.
Absolutely. And part of the reason, main reason for coming on this program is we get a chance to tell people that we are doing this tonight. We want you to come. We want you to come and listen and talk to the other people there. Ask questions, because really what we're trying to do is build a dialogue in this area, in this country, hopefully, that will start a movement of people looking at in a critical way at where we are and where we can be. And that's what we've tried to do all along. And I so please come out tonight to Downtown Presbyterian Church, second floor. It's 121 North Fitzhugh, opposite the City Hall parking lot. And if you want to come for the community potluck, just bring a dish to share at 5:30. If you want to just come for the program at 6:45, that's great too. And I want to thank that last caller because that was an amazing call.
Well, thank you for the time for the entire panel. Mary Boyd, who is with the Human Rights Day Committee, and Pat Mannix as well. Colin O'Malley, the organizing director of Metro Justice. Danielle Ponder, a criminal defense attorney with the Monroe County Public Defender's Office. Appreciate all of your time tonight, and let's continue the conversation on future days here as we talk about human rights, what economic systems mean, et cetera. I mean, I know we'll see all of you again.
We'll come back anytime.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Short break, and Democrats, Republicans joining us next hour as we look into the $1 billion Monroe County budget. Next.